Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests up today. First, in moments, federal budget pundit Stan Collender will outline the political theater on tap this year as a divided government, not just a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, but a Republican Party divided within itself, tries to keep the U.S. government running. And then at the bottom of the hour, economist David Kotz will tell us about the crisis in Russia as sanctions bite and the oil price collapses. First, Stan Collender. Collender has been working on federal budget issues for three decades, first as a congressional staffer and later as a private analyst. He's currently a columnist for Forbes and executive vice president of Corvus Communications, Corvus spelled with a U-less Q. You can find him on Twitter as the Budget Guy. With the divided Republican Party now controlling both houses of Congress, Washington is going to offer plenty of opportunity this year for anguish and or entertainment, depending upon your point of view. Nowhere will this be clearer than when it comes to fashioning a federal budget, the unglamorous essence of governing. No one knows the scene better than Stan Collender, and here he is with the details. Welcome, Stan. With this new configuration of Congress, there could be some budget melodrama ahead, right?
Not some. There's going to be a lot of melodrama. In fact, there almost isn't a month that goes by where there isn't some fiscally related deadline. It's almost like a series of fiscal cliffs that we're going to have through the year, but the politics is going to be what's the toughest.
All right, well, give us some idea of the calendar. What's the first drama going to be?
Well, you've got the Department of Homeland Security funding runs out the end of February. Then you've got Doc Fix. You've got the Highway Trust Fund. Each of these are successive months. You've got a debt ceiling fight somewhere around June. And, of course, you've got in September, you've got the fiscal year funding for 2016 for next year when there's a potential of a shutdown. So it's going to be just a series of these, month after month after month, and it's not likely they're going to be – and that, by the way, that doesn't even include the possibility of Congress passing a budget this year, of Congress then passing a reconciliation bill related to the budget that they passed that the president then vetoes. A lot of recriminations when they don't have the votes to override the veto. So it's going to be a year of just, you know, cliffhanger endings, you know, almost like in the old-fashioned serial where you come back month after month to the local movie theater to see what's going on.
And assuming Boehner holds on to his leadership, what do you think the Republican strategy is going to be going into all these budget fights? Is there going to be a unified strategy? Do they have a set of things they want to accomplish by playing chicken?
In spite of the fact that you've heard the word compromise and you know, get along and try to manage and govern, it looks to me as if, particularly on budget issues, but on all issues, the Republicans are going to try to score political points more than they are to try to get things done. And so that at the end of the year, a year from now, we may be talking about another do-nothing Congress. It'll be a different do-nothing Congress. That is, they may actually get some legislation passed, but it won't get enacted because the president will veto it, and the votes aren't there to override a veto on virtually anything. There'll be, you know, very little to have happen. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that the challenge to Boehner, or challenges to Boehner, indicate that there's a disturbance in the force in the Republican caucus in the House. That you know, the Tea Party type conservatives are basically telling Boehner, and they're telling the Senate, their Senate colleagues, Senate Republican colleagues, that don't get too moderate, don't get too chummy with the White House, because we're not going to stand for it. And while there may not be enough votes to unseat Boehner, there certainly will be enough votes to stop a lot of legislation if the Tea Party folks hang together and oppose the leadership.
And do they have an agenda, or do they just want to make Obama look bad and score political points?
Well, first of all, making Obama look bad is part of the agenda. You know, that is, they don't want him to succeed. They don't want to make it look like his presidency has been a success. But more than anything else, particularly on House Republicans, their agenda is to get reelected. I mean, that's been true for now several elections. It used to be a time when I first got to Washington anyway, when you came to the town – after election to do things. Now you come to Washington to get reelected. And so the Republicans are really playing to their base, House Republicans in particular. They're really trying to do things that would make their base think that they're on their side. That's everything from potential shutdowns to refusing to pass debt ceilings to doing a variety of things like that, even if it means you don't get much done. I mean, remember, there are a lot of people that were taking great glee in the Republican caucus. They were having, you know, a great pleasure in saying to their constituents, we didn't do anything. Aren't you glad? I mean, we didn't impose any new you know, new requirements. We didn't spend any more money. We didn't take any more of your taxes. We just didn't do anything. And therefore, a lot of folks in that, in the Republican caucus and their voters, that's what they want to have happen.
I recall when back in my misty days when I was a right winger, we used to make jokes about shortening the First Amendment to Congress shall pass no law. So they seem to be realizing that 40 years later.
Yeah, and as I said, this year it may be that they pass legislation, but they don't necessarily get anything enacted. And I'm not sure that that's their goal. All the talk about we want to show people we can govern is a little disingenuous, because people here means the Republican voters, not necessarily the broader, you know, voters for the general election. And for those folks, collaborating with the White House is the equivalent of collaborating with the enemy.
You say their base. I presume you mean their electoral base. But what about the business people that fund them, the rich people that fund them? They certainly want a functioning government, even if minimal, don't they?
Only for certain things. They want tax cuts. They want you know, increases in defense spending that will go to contractors. They want more money spent on highways. You know, and they want, you know, if you want to call it this, at a minimal, they don't want debt ceiling fights or you know, and those types of things. You can do all of that. That is, you can do a minimum with the debt ceiling, but you just have to make some folks, for political reasons, sweat over it. You don't just, if you're a Tea Party person, you don't just vote for a debt ceiling increase. You make it look like you've got something, anything in return. It's a little bit like, if you remember the movie Lawrence of Arabia, where Lawrence was trying to get the Arab chieftain to commit to fighting with him, and and the agreement was that he would get something honorable in exchange for fighting. That is, the Arab chieftain wouldn't fight unless he could go back to his people and say, this is what I got for it. That's what the Republicans are doing here, which is the Tea Party folks are saying, I'll vote for eventually for an increase in the debt ceiling, or I'll vote in for something else like that. But you're going to have to show me something. You're going to have to show the president had some sort of concession here. It could be no budget, no pay, that nonsense that they did several years ago. It could be something like that that's relatively meaningless, but shows that they were actually, you know, doing their job and trying to represent their constituents.
Are they going to play that game again where they threaten default, or is that that passed now?
I don't think there's any doubt that, that there are certain elements in the Republican Party in both houses will refuse to vote for a debt ceiling. Now, that's not the same as default, but it will be characterized as that. The problem with that is that the Republicans will, as they have in the past, Boehner has in the past, eventually go to Democrats and say, look, I need 20 votes. And the Democrats, because there's a Democratic president, will give them those 20 votes or however many they need, so that the Tea Party can be rendered relatively useless under those circumstances, but they still will put up a good fight. And Boehner can't give in until the very last minute on something like that. That's what he's done before, and he's gotten away with it.
It's just stunning to me that these guys would contemplate tarnishing the credit of the United States. What is behind this kind of thinking?
Well, you've got to remember, one of the basic principles of the Tea Party has been no increase in the debt ceiling, period. In fact, a quick story. In February 2011, which is now almost 4 years ago, I was the first speaker at the first meeting of the House Tea Party Caucus. I spoke about the debt ceiling, the process, and how it worked. And after me came the Tea Party chairs from Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida. And one of the things they insisted on was that members of the Tea Party, members of Congress, Republicans, not vote for an increase in the debt ceiling, period. And when I pointed out that at the time, with the deficit being $1.4 trillion, not increasing the debt ceiling would require a $1.4 trillion cut in federal spending to balance the budget, which is what they wanted to do, and that would be 10% of GDP at the time and 40% of federal spending, and would cause a deep recession, if not a depression, their response was, yeah, so what, at least we won't borrow any more money. It's important to keep in mind that these were sound bites that I was hearing. These are not based on facts. It's not clear to me that these folks understand what would happen. But it's an ideological play. It's not an emotional play. It's not really a factual, substantive argument.
Okay, let's go through some of the milestones. You mentioned the first one will be funding Homeland Security. Now, surely that's something that they consider a priority, isn't it?
I would think so. But the question is, how do they fund Homeland Security? I mean, remember, the reason they didn't fund Homeland Security through the whole year was because they wanted to put some leverage over the president on immigration, which is something that Homeland Security basically administers. It can't work. It won't work. The immigration laws that the president discussed or changed with executive orders all are self-funding, so there's really not much they can do. And it's hard for me to believe that a coalition of more moderate and that's a relative term, Republicans and Democrats wouldn't vote to pass Homeland Security. The question is, at what point can John Boehner and Mitch McConnell bring that bill forward with Democratic support, or does it look like, they are working too much with the other side and compromising too much? But it will be a drawn out fight. It'll go down right to the last minute. So don't expect much to change until funding's just about to run out, and you're seeing stories about how Homeland Security is getting ready to shut down. Also remember, though, that the president has the ability to designate various federal jobs as essential, and I would imagine that much of what's in Homeland Security would be designated essential and would continue anyway.
And then what comes after that? What's the next drama?
Next thing, let's see, is you've got the doc fix. That's the situation with Medicare, where the reimbursements for doctors, hospitals, and other providers would be cut. I think it's by more than 40% at this point. The only way they were able to get through that this last time was to do it temporarily. There will be a lot of pressure from the medical community on that. There always is. And I expect that there will be some accommodation at the last minute, something small. But again, this will go down to the very last possible moment. And one of the interesting things here is in what we've talked about so far, just these two things, is that in all likelihood, fiscal discipline is going to go down over the next 2 years rather than up. That is, with the Republican agenda on tax cuts, on defense spending, on doc fix, on the highway trust fund, which will run out of money May 31st, Congress is likely to approve and the president agree on additional spending that will get the deficit higher than it otherwise would be. And that wouldn't have happened if there was still a split Congress.
Well, the deficit right now, regardless of what you think is going to happen to it over the longer term, the deficit now is a fairly small thing, isn't it?
It is in percentage terms. It's the year that just ended, the deficit fell to $483 billion compared to about the $600 billion that it had been projected to be. It was 2.8% of GDP, which is back below its historical average for the last 40 years. The problem here is rhetoric and emotions. I've just given you some great statistics. And not only is the deficit low this year, it's gone from $1.4 trillion just in 2009 to about $483 billion, as I said, almost $1 trillion reduction in the space of 4 years. It's projected to keep going down for the next 3 or 4 years. It'll probably be close to 400 or a little bit lower this year, and way below that the year after, assuming the economy does as it's projected to do. This is good news, especially with the private sector doing well. But the question is, if you've got a $483 billion deficit like we had this past year, is that a high or too low? Now, I've written a bunch of columns about this in my Forbes column. And the angriest comments I get is only in Washington, something to the effect of, only in Washington could $483 billion be considered too low or a low deficit. And in fact, as I said, it's a $1 trillion reduction over what it was just 4 years ago. That's astounding.
Well, the only sensible way to measure these things is as a percentage of GDP, but is that too complicated for the rhetoricians?
Rhetoricians is making it sound a little bit too scholarly. I had most recently when I did a column about this, I had several people write in and say, oh, you're just looking at a percent of GDP because it makes things look smaller. That's the wrong measurement. It should be the absolute number, which is, of course, completely wrong from an economic standpoint. But from a political standpoint, when you're not trying to give the president any credit, that works just fine.
I'm speaking with the veteran federal budget pundit, Stan Collender. Now, the debt ceiling, that comes up in June, right?
And it comes up later. It comes up a little bit earlier officially. That is, I think it's good until the middle of March, the current debt ceiling, and then the Treasury will be doing, its so-called extraordinary measures, which is essentially borrowing money on your MasterCard to make a payment on your Visa, or taking money out of one pocket and putting it in another. And so they can probably get till about, with income tax payments in April, they can probably get to about June, the end of June, before it becomes a real problem. So somewhere around the middle of the year, Congress is going to have to vote to increase the debt ceiling.
And what are the odds that they're going to do it? Is it 100% sure, or is there a risk that they actually would?
Well, this is Washington. You never say that anything is 100% sure. But as sure as something can be in politics, there will be an increase in the debt ceiling, or the government will be allowed to borrow. Remember the way they've done it in the past. They just suspended the debt ceiling and then allowed the government to borrow whatever they want, whatever it needs to borrow up, until the next time, until the suspension runs out. There will be some accommodation along the way, but let's give it a 5% chance of not happening. That is that all hell breaks loose in Washington and Tea Party anger just rolls over and becomes much too high, and they decide to make a stand on it. Democrats say, you know what, if you guys can't get your act together, we're not going to help you make people think that you can govern. So we're not voting for it, at least the first time. So it's possible that for a couple of days at least, just for a couple of days, that the government may run out of the ability to borrow. But I don't think it would be any more than that. That would be extremely damaging. And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, the business community, the Wall Street allies in Washington, of the Republicans, will be putting a lot of pressure on them to not let that happen.
And, of course, because the debt ceiling provides such an opportunity for fun times, there's absolutely no possibility that the whole thing would ever be scrapped, is there?
Unfortunately, no. It makes very little sense to pass a budget that assumes an increase in the government borrowing, that is with a deficit, but then doesn't include legislation or doesn't automatically increase the deficit. And we're one of the few countries that has a separate debt limit vote. And it would make a great deal of sense from logistically and rationally to get rid of the debt ceiling, but politically there's no way they're going to do it. I mean, that would have to be something I mean, the Tea Party would have to be absent that day to allow that to happen, and I can't imagine Republicans non-Tea Party Republicans would go for it, because that would probably engender primary challenges to many of them, for 2016.
And then the big enchilada, the budget itself, fiscal year begins October 1st. What are the likelihood that we're going to have a budget when October 1st hits?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I mean, to me, I'm watching this very closely, because I think it's going to be an indication of what could or should happen this year. The assumption was right after on election night that with Republicans taking control of the Senate, that there'd be no trouble with the House and Senate passing a budget, compromising on a budget, and especially because it can't be filibustered under existing rules. The Democrats would have very little ability to stop it from happening. It doesn't have to be signed by the president, so it can't be vetoed. I'm not so sure that the House and Senate Republicans are going to be able to come up with a compromise. They probably will, but you've got to keep in mind that House Republicans are much more fiscally conservative than the Senate counterparts. More importantly, 24 of the 34 senators up for election in 2016 are Republicans, and at least 10 to 12 of them are from blue states, states that Obama won. If that's the case, then a lot of these Republicans from blue states up for re-election in 2016 won't be able to vote for the Medicare, Medicaid, maybe Social Security or other cuts that the House Republicans want. Now, what do you do then? House Republicans have a very, very conservative budget, let's say. Senate Republicans send them something that's more moderate, saying we can't vote for this, and if we do, we'll lose our majority. The House Republicans take it back and say, we're not going to compromise because this is about principle, and you have to come in our direction rather than the other way. So it's entirely possible, maybe even likely, that the fight over the budget resolution this year, while a lot of people thought it was going to be a slam dunk, is going to be a lot tougher. It's probably a 60% chance that we actually get a budget resolution. There's probably a 0% chance that even if we do, that any of the legislation needed to implement it, that is the appropriations cuts, the tax cuts, or the reconciliation bill, would ever be signed by the president and or overridden by the Congress.
Now, you said the president can't veto a budget resolution?
Yeah, a budget resolution is not a law. It's what's known as technically a concurrent resolution. So it doesn't require the president's signature to go into effect. It's essentially just an internal working document of Congress. So the House passes something, the Senate passes something, the two sides compromise, and if they both pass the compromised version of the budget resolution, it goes into effect. And that's, again, just an internal working document of Congress. It's Congress promising itself what it's going to do the rest of the year. So it can't be filibustered in the Senate. There's a time limit on debate, unlike almost all other legislation. It can't be vetoed by the president. So it goes into effect as soon as the House and Senate pass something. What doesn't go into effect is all the other legislation needed to implement the budget resolution, which has to be a law according to the Constitution.
Yeah, that's where you actually appropriate the money that's actually spent.
Right. You appropriate the money, you create the entitlement programs, or you cut the entitlement programs, or you cut taxes. That's all the other things you have to do. The budget is just, this is what we promise we're going to do. We promise everyone we're going to do if we're good at what, and you can hold us to it.
And so will there be a drama over every appropriations bill as well?
Well, I'm not so sure they get to individual appropriations bills either. There are 12 individual appropriations bills, and last year they didn't, actually for the last few years, they haven't been able to get to come up with individual appropriations bills simply because there hasn't been enough time, and because the scrutiny that the members would give to each individual bill would be too great, the political problems would be tremendous. So I'm expecting some sort of omnibus bill like we had this past year. That is, take 6, 7, 8, or maybe even all 12 of the appropriations bills, put them in one big package like the one we had this year that was 1,600 pages, and give everybody no chance to read it, debate it, argue about it, and even if you don't like a particular provision, you're not going to vote against the whole bill just for that one reason.
This process, to an outsider, sounds completely insane. Has it gotten more insane over the years, or has it always been the level of insanity to it?
Well, it's interesting. The process that Congress is using now essentially was created in 1974, went into effect in 1976. It was a little bit more rational back then, when the process first started, because everybody was committed to it. But since then, as the deficit's gotten bigger and as the decisions to reduce the deficit have gotten more politically difficult, members of Congress have simply avoided the decisions they didn't want to make. They didn't pass individual bills. They didn't pass budgets because they didn't want to vote for a high deficit. So it's become more ridiculous. What's happened here is that the commitment to doing a budget that we had back when Tip O'Neill and Richard Bolling were running the House of Representatives and thought of themselves as the father of the budget process, that commitment doesn't exist, and members are just trying to survive politically.
The fact that the deficit now is under 3% of GDP, has that taken some of the salience out of the deficit issue politically?
No, not at all. As we talked about a little while ago, two things will happen. One, as we talked about a little while ago, people will still talk about $486 billion as being ridiculously high. As you and I know from an economics point of view, that's just not true, but this is the equivalent of climate deniers. The deficit may be small from an economic standpoint, but from a rhetorical, emotional, political standpoint, it can be made to sound like it's very high. The other thing that's happened is that a lot of the deficit hawks have shifted their focus from the deficit to the debt, which is still going up. I mean, the deficit may be coming down in nominal terms from $1.4 trillion to $483 billion, but every year we run a deficit, the debt goes up, and so now we're talking about national debts of $17, $18 trillion and going to be increasing for several years, maybe lots of more years. The fact that that is projected to fall as a percent of GDP is also irrelevant. It's just when you're talking about $17 trillion in debt, it's easy for folks who don't know to go, oh, my God, how can that possibly be? These people are a bunch of charlatans.
So you could pile up the $100 bills that reach to Pluto or something, right?
The old Ronald Reagan thing, which is, a stack of bills running, around the moon several times. Ridiculous examples, but work rhetorically.
And then finally, are they going to try to use any of these budget processes to chip away at or repeal Obamacare?
Well, the answer is yes, but the only budget process that's really possible to chip away, repeal, or make changes in Obamacare is what's known as reconciliation. Reconciliation is the process Congress uses after it passes a budget resolution to enforce the changes in mandatory spending, which is what a lot of Obamacare is. But that tells you several things. First, they have to have a budget resolution, which, as we talked about a few minutes ago, is not all clear they can do. Second, there are strict limits on what you can put in reconciliation. And while they can blow some holes in Obamacare, Congress can't repeal it or make overwhelming changes. On top of everything else, a reconciliation bill can, and if it made changes in Obamacare, almost certainly would be vetoed by the president, and there wouldn't be the votes to override. So Congress, the Republican Congress's best shot at doing something substantial to reduce the value of Obamacare is with the Supreme Court and the challenges that it's currently going to be hearing this year.
That was Stan Collender, who's been following the federal budget for 3 decades. He's a columnist for Forbes and an executive vice president of Corvus Communications. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Pink Floyd's Money, performed by an L.A.-based string quartet called The Section. Next, David Kotz. The Russian economy, never a very healthy thing, has been thrown into crisis, first by Western sanctions in response to the annexation of Crimea, and more recently by the collapse in oil prices, from over $100 a barrel this past summer to around $50 today. While this will have a stimulative effect on the overwhelming majority of the world economy that isn't involved in energy production, it's hammering the energy-producing regions of the world. It's bad news for the atmosphere, too, if lower prices stimulate more use, it goes without saying, not that anything really goes without saying. David Kotz is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who's been following the Soviet and post-Soviet economy for more than 20 years. Apologies for the suboptimal Skype sound quality. David was at a conference, and it was either this or a cell phone. What's the dimensions of the Russian crisis right now? What's happening to the Russian economy?
The big thing is that the price of oil is down. It's fallen to below $60 a barrel from over 100. And the Russian economy is a petrostate. Its oil and gas revenues supply 60% of their export revenues and about half their budget revenues. So this is a huge hit. And this is intensified by the Western sanctions.
Yeah, how badly are those sanctions biting?
It's hard to know. The Russians insist that they're not very effective. It's very contentious. It's causing problems for the Russian financial sector and for Russian firms that are accustomed to borrowing in the West. Big companies in Russia have in recent years borrowed a lot, some of it short to medium term, so they have to keep refinancing it. They borrow in dollars. And they are being squeezed on access to Western sources of credit. And this is going to cause a problem for the companies in Russia as the debt matures.
You say that Russia is a petrostate. It's an enormous country. It's not like, you know, a little relatively small population like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. How does a country that large run on the model of what is usually thought of as a smaller state? How can you run a country of hundreds of millions of people on just mostly oil?
You do it by screwing the great majority of the population. Kuwait has a pretty prosperous citizenry as a petrostate, but they have less than a million citizens. Russia has some 145 million, maybe a bit less, because it shrinks every year. People, and most of them have no place in the petrostate. So a small, you know, the oligarchs keep getting huge revenues from the oil exports, and a somewhat larger group, maybe 10-15% of the population, indirectly get income that derives ultimately from the oil exports, but most of the population are cut out. And they're not doing well. They're still, the majority is still worse off than they were at the end of the Soviet period. And still has terrible social indicators. Petrostate model is a disaster for a big country with urbanized, highly educated populations such as Russia.
Well, the classic social structure of a petrostate is a small elite rakes off all the money and the rest, the majority of people get crumbs. Does that apply in the Russian case?
Yeah, that's what applies.
And who is this elite? How did they get to this position?
I've been following this since 1992, and in my view, it is essentially the shock therapy neoliberal policy adopted by the post-Soviet Russian state under President Boris Yeltsin that transformed the Russian economy into a petro-state. Russia, as part of the Soviet Union, had had a diversified, highly industrialized economy, made a wide variety of products and services. And as the former state socialist system was dismantled during 1990 to 91, there was a debate over what to do next. And there were groups that argued for a kind of a state-managed gradual transition to capitalism, such as China has followed. But they lost out. And the advocates of immediate weakening of the state, belief that the free market would spring up to take its place, there was no effort to use the state to direct Russia's transition and development, and the global capitalist markets took over. And what the global capitalist market wanted from Russia was oil and gas and some metals and chemicals. And so that's all that has prospered in Russia. Everything else declined and collapsed. I expected that after a few years, the part of the new capitalist class in Russia that ended up owning the productive manufacturing enterprises, machine tools, etc., would be able to gather enough political power to shift toward a developmental state model. But they never did. And I concluded eventually that even those new capitalists who ended up owning productive enterprises discovered that although their enterprise lost money every year because of the neoliberal strategy, nevertheless, the owners were able to skim off huge revenues through, for example, setting up fictitious companies to sell fictitious services to the company. So enterprises that were losing money, that couldn't pay their workers' wages, that couldn't pay their taxes, nevertheless produced big profit streams for the owners. And they realized that if there was a shift to a developmental state approach, they wouldn't be able to do that. Profits would have to be gained and plowed back into developing the enterprise with less to them as individuals. So that has created a powerful political base for this petro-state model.
You said earlier that under the Soviet regime, the country was a diversified producer of industrial goods and services. I think a lot of people would say it was all crap and it deserved to die. Was it all crap and did it deserve to die?
No, it was not all crap. It did not deserve to die. The groups that say that are, some of them are Western neoliberal economists who assume that if the enterprises were part of a central planning mechanism and state-owned, then they must have been crap. And some of them were Western interests who didn't want competition from one more developed economy and who hoped to see Russia become a petro-state. At the end of the Soviet period, Russia's and the Soviet Union in general's economy was at the world frontier in some products. It was uneven. I'll give you some examples. They were at the world technological frontier in a whole series of industrial products. For example, the rails that were produced when the Washington, D.C. metro system was constructed in the 1970s were made with Soviet-manufactured seamless rail-laying machines. They didn't purchase them because they wanted to help the Soviet economy. They were the best in the world. Optical equipment. Metallurgy, Western transnational corporations licensed technologies in metallurgy from Soviet enterprises. There were a whole series in which they were at the world frontier. Then there were there was a much larger set of industries in which they produced moderate quality products at low prices, such as tractors and other farm equipment, automobiles, which they were selling all around the world, mainly in less developed and medium developed countries where farmers, say, couldn't afford Japanese or U.S. tractors, Russian tractors, cost about one-tenth as much. They were not as high quality, but they were a good bargain. They were sold in New England, in the USA. They could have been upgraded. I visited enterprises in Russia, post-Soviet Russia, in 1992 and 93, where the director said, if we could get financing, if we could get help with marketing, we could upgrade and compete in world markets, but we can't get it. We can't get credit. We can't get any help from the state. And they just withered away.
The undoing of the Soviet Union. As I recall, you argued that it was a decision of the Soviet elite, that they wanted to pull the plug on communism. They wanted to become more like a Western elite. Is that a fair characterization of what happened?
Exactly. And my co-author in the book, Revolution from Above, from 1997, my co-author, Fred Weir, married into the Soviet elite. He was from Canada, and he was from a Canadian Communist Party family. And when he went to Moscow in the 1980s and married Masha Shumshamian, she is the granddaughter of a famous Armenian Bolshevik, Stepan Shamian, he was shocked to discover that his wife's circle of friends didn't like Soviet socialism and greatly admired Western capitalism. That's what they wanted. And that led us to do a research project interviewing various officials in the Soviet elite, the former Soviet elite as the system collapsed. And we found that a sizable majority of high-level officials in the Communist Party, their various state institutions, had turned against socialism. They didn't like the old version of it. They were not enthusiastic about Gorbachev's proposal to democratize socialism, which would have reduced their power and privileges. They hungered for the far greater wealth and power that Western capitalist elites had. And they had the strategic position that enabled them, by lining up behind Boris Yeltsin, to dismantle the system rapidly and relatively peacefully.
And from their point of view, it worked all beautifully, right? They ended up getting state property for a song and becoming rich.
Well, it was mixed. Some of them, the ones who had no conscience whatsoever, who cared only about their own wealth, it worked great, very well. Some of them believed, strongly influenced by Western liberal ideology, that a shift to capitalism would not only enrich them, but would be good for Russia. It would improve the economy. And some of them, within a year or two, regretted their move. One leading economist and policymaker who had become a follower of Milton Friedman at the end of the Soviet period, within a year or two, shifted back to believing central planning was best. So there were some who regretted what had happened.
But then it was too late, yes. So in that transition process, it destroyed the industrial base of the former Soviet Union and left Russia and its neighbor successor republics nothing more than a natural resource exporter. There's not much substance to the economy beyond that.
That's right. And, you know, at the beginning in the 90s, there was an extreme impoverishment of the majority. GDP, economic output, fell by 50%, while inequality skyrocketed. So the majority was impoverished. There was real suffering. I mean, the death rates shot up. The birth rate collapsed. The death rate came to exceed the birth rate by 5 per 1,000. In the mid and late 1990s. Then as the petrostate got fully organized and as oil prices increased in the 2000s, the economy in the big major cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, began to look prosperous as the oil revenues flowed in. But if you go outside of the few biggest cities, it's still very impoverished.
I'm sitting with David Kotz, who's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and is the author of The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism, which will be out any day now from Harvard University Press. And what did Putin do? It looks from the outside like he at least stabilized a collapsing country, but what beyond that has he done? What characterizes the Putin regime?
Well, this is widely misunderstood. There is a common view that Putin ended normal capitalism in Russia and brought state capitalism, with the state running the economy. That is not what happened. In the Yeltsin years, in the 1990s, the oligarchs, the people who got the plums of the Soviet inheritance, oil, gas, metals, actually dominated the state. And the state pretty much collapsed in the 1990s. There was chaos. Organized criminal groups rose to a very powerful position. What Putin did, it's sort of like a shift from competitive capitalism to monopoly capitalism. Under Putin, the few top oligarchs pushed out the small-scale organized criminals to the margins of society, and Putin became essentially the chief oligarch. He centralized power in the state. It had been significantly decentralized within the Russian state to the regions and localities. Putin re-centralized power even more than it had been in the Soviet period. Power was really centralized in the Kremlin, and he made it clear that the oligarchs, as long as they didn't challenge his authority, could continue doing what they've been doing, making fortunes. Any who challenged his power were either arrested or driven out of the country. And Putin's circle is best understood as the chief oligarchic circle. They're greatly enriching themselves out of this process. They have nationalized a few strategic companies. The military, the weapons producers have remained state-owned. They nationalized the Gazprom, the natural gas company, some of the oil companies, aircraft manufacturing. But the state has not used its power to try to direct the development of the economy. So it remains a neoliberal strategy. The global capitalist market directs Russia's continuing underdevelopment as a petrostate.
So what happens to Russia if oil prices stay $50 or below rather than, you know, $100 and above?
This is a very interesting question. And I should actually finish my last point by adding that Putin is popular because he established political order. He reduced the small-scale crime, the purse snatching and muggings on the streets. He created some order, and this is greatly appreciated by the average Russian. But the economy is still in very bad shape. Now, what lies ahead? If oil prices bounce back up to $100 a barrel, then I think the regime will survive without significant change. But there's a significant likelihood, if you look at the trends, that oil prices may remain in the $50-$60 range, given the big increase in global supply, mainly from fracking in the U.S., and the slowdown in demand growth due to stagnation in a major part of the global economy and a slowdown of growth in China. And then there's the continuing squeezing of Russia by the sanctions. Taking account of these factors, the current petrostate model may be unviable. Russia is being cut out of global capitalism in certain ways by the sanctions, on top of the much lower energy prices. So one possibility for the regime would be to form an alliance with China to pair Russia's plentiful raw materials with China's manufacturing prowess to form a bloc that could be a serious rival of the U.S.-dominated global system. That would enable Russia to continue as a petrostate. The elite could continue that way. But I think it's unlikely that China would go for such a deal. China has a very favorable position in the U.S.-dominated global system, and I don't think they're willing to give that up. So it may actually occur, ironically, that if the combination of low oil, combination of U.S. fracking and U.S. sanctions make a continued petrostate strategy unviable economically, there may be a transformation in Russia. Putin, who has enormous power, if he concludes that the only way he can hold on to power is by giving up the petrostate and finally shifting to a developmental state model, he might be able to bring along a section of the oligarchs, clamp down on those powerful economic figures who are unwilling to give up on the petrostate model, and shift toward a developmental state model.
Could you give more detail on what you mean by a developmental state model?
It means the state would use oil revenues to invest in Russian industry, in Russian science and technology, in innovation, in building infrastructure, transportation, communication, power. invest in those industries that can be revived and can compete in world markets. That is still, I believe, a viable economic strategy for Russia. Something like what South Korea did starting in the 1950s when its per capita income was at the level of most African states. This is a viable strategy in Russia. It was in the early 90s. It would be more difficult today, but it would be possible. But it would require that the petro revenue would be directed not into the pockets of the oligarchs to invest in London real estate, but to invest in upgrading and modernizing the industrial sector of the Russian economy and building infrastructure and upgrade education.
How big is that oligarch class?
It's relatively small. I mean, it's, you know, the top oligarchs are about 12 or 15, and then there's a larger number of wealthy capitalists, probably several thousand, who have become extremely wealthy, maybe 5 to 10,000, the ones who go to the Western resorts. And then there's a much larger middle class that is moderately prosperous, that's hooked in to the petrostate, selling a good or service in one way or another that is related to the petrostate.
So there would be, it would be very hard to find a social base for that kind of developmental state transition you're talking about, then.
The social base for this would be the capitalists in the productive sector, while they've been getting rich, you know, they would see the positive side of this, of a developmental state. There are even a few, and I've met some, who have continued to argue for a developmental state approach. A year and a half ago, I attended a conference funded by a Russian capitalist in farm machinery who was condemning the petrostate approach and demanding essentially a developmental state approach. And I asked him, you know, how he made his money. And he said, well, he'd been able to buy out a Canadian farm equipment company, and they sold, they had a very big market in Latin America and even in Canada. And I asked him, how many tractors had they sold in Russia in the last year? And he said, 15. and he wants to create a Russian market. So there are some like him, and there are others who've been silent, but who would see the benefits of this. And then there's the labor movement in Russia, which would be an ally of such policy.
Do people look at China as a model?
Yes, they see China as the model. That has been from 1992, the China model. That's what people have talked about. Russia needs a China model. And the neoliberals would say, well, there's only one problem. There aren't any Chinese here, so we can't do it. And so we just need to continue focusing on oil.
Because there's something in Chinese genes that makes it possible?
Was it? Yes. Nothing especially Chinese. Well, I mean, there are some cultural features of the China model, but you know, South Korea did it. They're not Chinese. Turkey did it. They're not Chinese. Japan did it. They're not Chinese. Those are all developmental state models.
Now, of course, the U.S. Has long aligned with interests in Russia that essentially wanted to remove it as any kind of military or industrial rival, right? So the petrostate model for Russia is something that the U.S. State Department was very pleased with, right?
Well, they make noises about how they need to diversify the economy, but they're not serious about it. They are happy with this. They know that ultimately Russia as a petrostate will continuously weaken as a military power. It can't remain a great power because the society is so sick and in decline. It's hard to find enough healthy people to staff the military in Russia. If Russia shifts to a developmental state model, this will be portrayed in the West as the revival of the Soviet system.
And aside from a small elite, the majority of the Russian population is worse off than it was when the USSR collapsed.
That's right. And there is still another option, a final option, and that is a return to an effort to build a democratic form of socialism that I believe was the basis of Gorbachev's original program. It's not impossible that there will be a revival of a mass movement in Russia. You know, a large part of the population remembers Soviet socialism, despite its deformations, as a period when they were better off. And it is possible that the socialist movement will revive in Russia and could become a player in the direction of Russia's development, although there's no sign of it now.
Well, I admire your optimism, David.
Well, I'm influenced by the fact that if you look at history, every major social transformation in history, as far as I know, was not foreseen in advance, and shortly before it happened, appeared highly unlikely. So it can happen again.
That was David Kotz, professor of economics at UMass. He's got a piece on the nation's website exploring the Russian economic crisis. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Speaking of the Soviet Union, let's go out with this, Paul Robeson's rendition of its national anthem. The tune, by the way, is now the Russian national anthem, though with new words. Till next week, bye.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire.